You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com. You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Everybody, thank you for joining us as always. This has been a great year for the markets, and we've been doing these spaces, specifically those of FOMC, pretty much every month, and we're really excited to round up the final Twitter space this year with our favorite people on the planet. So happy December to everybody. We got two more weeks left in the year. Now, before we get started, as those who frequent our spaces know, I like to keep these panels super open for discussion. So kind of as we go along, panelists, as always, you know the drill. Feel free to discuss openly. Add any thoughts you may have on any given topic we might touch on. Only request, as always, is that you use your little Twitter space emoji hand raise and keep your mics muted when others are talking, just to avoid any of that background noise or feedback. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and run through our panelists. Obviously, once I call your name, give your little intro, feel free to plug anything you've got going on. We'll start off here with Joseph Wang, our go-to Fed guy. As many of you know, he headed the trading at the Fed's open markets desk and has a great introductory book on central banking called Central Banking 101. And he's the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, as always, Joseph.
Hey, Nicholas. Hey, everyone. Great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me. These are my favorite spaces, and it's great to see all the panelists again. I always learn a lot from them.
I do, too. I mean, it's really a testament to how much I think I know and how little I actually know anytime I ask you guys questions. So thanks for coming, Joseph. Next, we've got Randy Woodward, a bond investor for 30 years, was working at Bloomberg from 1988 to 95, and now an almost regular to our unusual spaces as well, and a great follow for all things macro. Welcome back, Randy.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I look forward to doing this and catching up with the fellas again. And the only thing I would plug is Joseph's book. You should definitely read Central Bank 101, because I learned a lot reading that, and it was very informative.
Love to hear it, Randy. Joseph. Thank you. And I couldn't agree more. Next, we've got Jem Karsan, a leading volatility expert and founder of Kai Volatility. They're launching a ton of new and innovative things in the coming months, so keep an eye on Kai and check them out. Welcome back, Jem. Excited to have you again.
Always good to be here, fellas. I feel like we've reached the mission accomplished part for the Fed here, and I mean that ironically, in the sense that I could see a lot of that going on, while ironically, maybe the mission is not yet accomplished.
Next, we've got the Last Bear Standing, another frequent friend of our spaces. Last Bear is an expert on the markets, where he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that Substack, please check out his Twitter page and do that. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure to do these spaces, so looking forward to it.
And last but not least, certainly, we've got our incumbent urban cowboy, Michael Cow, the Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager of Cow Family Office, and an expert in commodities, index arbitrage, and dynamic hedging. He's also one of the most quotable people on the planet. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, geez, you're too kind. You guys do such a great job moderating these spaces. So I really appreciate being part of it. And of course, all the panelists, all of whom I highly respect. So I'm very excited to be here. Thanks.
Excited to have you. Thanks for this kind words, Michael. And I just want to, keep it pretty clear that without you guys, this would be the most awkward space on the planet, because I'd be up here floundering, tripping over words without anything to say without you guys. So thanks for coming. So before we get started here, I want to take a quick macro overview of the last month since our last panel. The Consumer Price Index for November showed that overall inflation climbed 0.1% on a monthly basis, making for a 3.1% increase compared to a year earlier. Current dollar GDP increased 8.9% at an annual rate, with real gross domestic product increasing at an annual rate of 5.2% in the third quarter of 2023. Equities, as I'm sure you've all noticed, have remained hot, with the S&P continuing its upside rally from October lows as inflation fears seem to dwindle, reaching new highs, and many calling for rate cuts to begin much sooner than expected. So with that said, let's jump right into this. Now, Joseph, in your recent Fed Guy publication, Crash Up, you cite near-term positivity in the equity markets and the dwindling attraction to treasuries. You also touch on runaway deficit spending and potential future rate cuts. As you put it, significant upside risk can be created to equity prices. Without giving too much of that publication away, which everyone should be subscribed to, by the way, can you touch on some of this, Joseph, to start us off?
Yeah, I think what's really changed in the macro backdrop over the past few years is that there's been this huge cultural shift in how we approach government. So, 20 years ago, there would be a lot of people talking about we should have a balanced budget, we should not spend too much money. And those people are all gone now. So if we look at our budget deficit today, like you mentioned, Nicholas, great overview. Our real GDP and nominal GDP are surging. And at the same time, our deficit spending is 7%, and it's projected to go like this, basically without bounds. Now, at a high level, when I think about deficit spending, you are basically buying goods and services and paying with treasury securities. It's functionally like money printing. And when you do this to a great extent, then it's going to be very positive for asset prices. And it's going to be upward pressure on inflation. So we have this huge, huge backdrop there that I think is very bullish for equity markets. But usually when we think about this though, there are pushbacks against it. One, you have the central bank who could raise rates. And secondly, you have the bond market, which could actually adjust rates themselves higher. Now, those two factors have been pushing against this tremendous tailwind for equity markets the past year, but it seems like they're fading away. The expectation in the market now is that the Fed will begin to cut rates maybe up to 5 times next year. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's the expectation. And you look at the bond market, long bond, 10-year yield, it's all come down significantly. So when you're taking away these things that push against this really big tailwind for inflationary assets, I think then you have a scenario where the risks are balanced towards a crash up. And of course, right now, there's really important options activity as well. And Jim's going to talk about it. It's like magic to me, but it's really important.
Thank you, Joseph. So, Michael, I'm going to kick it over your way here. You recently tweeted, massive easing of FCI begets resurgent CPI. Who could have seen that one coming? Now, I suspect based on the tone of that tweet, Michael, you did indeed see that coming. So can you kind of walk through your thoughts here, Michael?
Well, I've been and still remain in the higher for longer camp. And I think that the way I look at it is that we're making a vodka Red Bull here, okay? We've got a combination of fiscal Red Bull being poured on by all of the various spending bills, plus Janet Yellen. And then we've got the Fed trying to administer the monetary depressant. And right now, the fiscal is really overwhelming the monetary. The problem, though, I see, is that ultimately,
it boxes the Fed in. And, you know, when you add a little bit too much Red Bull into the mix, well, you have to, quote, dilute it with a little bit more vodka. And the end result is the same. Everybody gets wrecked in the end. So that's my quick little vodka Red Bull mental model for what's happening here. I wrote a piece earlier in the year called The Four Horsemen of U.S. Economic Resilience. And those four horsemen are, in no particular order, I believe there are structural and demographic reasons for why the super core, that, like, for instance, the shelter and labor components of inflation are somewhat sticky. Even though in 2021, I said that, you know, oil is the spark that lit the tinder that basically started what I call this inflation conflagration. It's no longer sustaining it. It's being sustained by these four horsemen of economic resilience, the first of which is the structural and demographic component that I mentioned. The second one, the largest horseman of all, is this fiscal tailwind. And someone posted a poll this morning about, you know, where a bunch of us think the dots are going to end up. And I said, you know, I think I'd put only a 25% chance of a 50 basis point cut in 2024, and less than 10% of more than that right now. I think the box is, I think the Fed is boxed in. And, you know, I retweeted something I included. I tweeted maybe 2 months ago saying that, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, and the CHIPS Act have a combined $2.2 trillion of fiscal spend earmarked over the next 5 to 10 years. And as of November, based on what I was able to find, a whopping $16 billion of that $2.2 trillion has been spent. I mean, that is just an enormous flood of fiscal stimulus that's yet to come. So that's only the second horseman. The third horseman is relative rate insensitivity of the U.S. consumer and the U.S. corporate sector. We all know that the U.S. homeowner is enjoying I think the U.S. has one of the, if not the lowest.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Percentages of floating rate mortgages in the world. And then on the corporate side of things, less than 25% of U.S. corporate debt is floating rate. So that's the third horseman. The fourth horseman is relative energy independence. And, you know, I follow oil very, very closely. The U.S. is by far the largest producer of oil in the world right now. We're hitting almost 13.3 million barrels per day. So now, even though oil prices have come crashing down recently and it's no longer an issue for anybody right now, I would argue, earlier in the year, certainly, the inflationary pressures brought on by high oil prices were least felt by the U.S. consumer. So the problem here, I think, for the world and for potentially asset prices, eventually long duration asset prices, they certainly are shrugging all of this off right now because everybody thinks that inflation is going to come right back and be boxed in very neatly. I just don't think so. I think that even though oil was the spark that started this, oil is no longer sustaining the current inflation. And if the Fed does what the market is pricing in, it will simply reignite all of this dry tinder.
So I'm just going to jump in here if that's okay. I have a tremendous respect for Michael, and we've talked many times and learned so much from him. But I am going to disagree with certain things. I don't think that oil was a spark. I think this has been, and other people who follow me will know this thought, but I really want to hammer this home. It really is something that's been building for some time, and it's really tied to populism. I think everything here, these aren't different components. If you look on the internet for like what drove the inflation in the 1970s, right, you'll get a bunch of different reasons. And what people don't realize is that they're all connected. And they're all connected to this idea of populism. Monetary policy drove dramatic inequality in the world for 40 years, particularly here in the US and the developed world. That eventually, it started about a decade ago, leads to people to this let them eat cake moment. And we've kind of been at that for a while. You know, Trump bringing the right left was kind of the initial kind of last step, and COVID was the spark. The fiscal wave that we've experienced, to Michael's point, I'll agree, has been the driver, but it really is a symptom of something that is much more structural, that is unavoidable. We have taken the pendulum too far, and guess what? That pendulum is swinging back, and now there's inflation to pay. The things that are all connected are not just the fiscal spending, but the deglobalization that comes from populism. You have a whole generation that's coming to political dominance, millennials on down, who have gone through 40 years of underperforming their peers, the boomers. They're at 40% of the wealth creation, 40% of the household formation, and they're saying enough is enough, and they're voting for change, for populist measures. That's not only fiscal spending, that's protectionism. That protectionism drives deglobalization. Populism is people. That means they are local. We don't care about the people of China. We don't care about the people. The people of China don't care about us. When we're in a monetary-driven system, and it's about corporations, right? It has nothing to do with borders. It has nothing to do with the people of a place. It has to do with profits, and that is much more efficient. So deglobalization means more war, economic war, actual war. Vietnam spending in the 1970s was a huge driver of inflation. Guess what? Spending in Ukraine, spending in Israel, spending in all these different new global war fronts is going to continue to also drive inflation. Commodity scarcity, the competition, OPEC crisis is the 1970s. Guess what? OPEC's out there flexing their muscles again, and every other commodity where that is centralized in a certain country, that protectionism and that desire to flex your muscles and get some advantage and competition is another driver of inflation. These things aren't going away. Fiscal spending is not going away. Deglobalization, war, economic, you know, the protectionism, it's not going away. And these are secular forces. Got to wake up to the secular forces. We can talk about the cyclical. We can talk about recession. Is recession here? Is recession not here? 1970s, we had three recessions over the 1970s. Did inflation go away? Maybe for a second. The map is 6% inflation to 3% in the 1970s, 70 to 72. Then that's 12% in 74, then 6% in 76, then 15% in 1980. So this is a secular structural reality that we're going in, and you can create recessions throughout that and cyclical downturns of inflation. But the important part is what is happening to services, what is happening to people on the ground, and where is the money going? And it's going to demand, not supply anymore.
Thank you, Jem. Michael and Joseph, I see your hands, but real quick, I want to spin something that Jem brought up to Randy here, and then I'm going to kick it around the whole panel, starting with you two for your thoughts. Now, Randy, Janet Yellen recently said in an interview with Nick Timmerau, inflation is, quote, certainly meaningfully coming down, and I see no reason why inflation shouldn't gradually decline to levels that are consistent with the Fed's mandate. She continued, I personally don't see any good reason to think that the last mile is going to be especially difficult. Now, Randy, is Yellen correct that inflation is coming down in a meaningful fashion? And kind of as a tie-in, are we on the right trajectory for the soft landing the Fed has been targeting and promoting?
Well, I think on the whole, you know, it certainly, you know, measures that inflation has been coming down for quite some time. And, you know, I don't think this morning's PPI report should be ignored. I mean, it seems it usually is ignored, but, you know, I think PPI year over year, ex food and energy, was right at 2%, which takes us back to when we fell below 2% in late 2019. I don't think that should be ignored as a metric. You know, for me, and the other one too, you know, more myopically, right? Everybody here seems to be, you know, very knowledgeable macro, which I'm probably not nearly as good as they are at this, but I'll just feed on the ground stuff. You know, I think Lacey Hunt's ODL, you know, other deposit liabilities, you know, which is basically just saying available deposits for commerce, you know, for consumers, has been coming down dramatically since its peak. I think it's down $1.5 to $2 trillion. So I get the money printing and the fiscal spending, but it's not getting to the consumers. And my, you know, as I'll remind everybody, you know, my entire career is basically helping banks manage their assets, which is, you know, the bond portfolio and you know, loan portfolio as well. They're just all in survival mode right now. Everybody's pulling in, you know, in every, but no one's growing. I got a lot of banks that are shrinking, and it's just, you know what? I just want to survive this, whatever's coming. And they all know there's going to be a problem with CRE. You know, I mean, commercial real estate is going to be a problem. And, you know, that's going to rear its ugly head sometime next year. I think we're going to start getting some reality there. So, yeah, my opinion is I think there's a lot of forces out there that are going to have, you know, pressure on prices in general.
Thank you, Randy. So real quick, Jem, I see your hand as well, but let's start with Michael, then Joseph here. Any continuing thoughts on what Jem and Randy have just said? Let's start, Michael.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to quickly acknowledge Jem and Jem's comments and say, Jem, I've learned a ton from you on your work on the flows. And yeah, I was recently following your debate with Andy Constant. And I come down on your side because I don't want to be that guy that, you know, bases everything on home court bias and say that one factor started everything when there are, in truth, many collinear factors, right? And the market is a very, very complex weighing machine, ultimately. So I agree with all of your comments on the structural, what I call dry tender, 100%. The reason why I pointed to oil as perhaps the spark that let that dry tender, while acknowledging that, you know, the reason why the oil rallied fiercely in 2021 in the first place was driven by a lot of these underlying sort of like a perfect storm of factors coming out of COVID, et cetera, et cetera. Oil is still it's the most important global commodity in the world. And it's certainly, it's one of the reasons why I tend to overweight its importance. And I think that the rally and its persistently high oil prices bleed into a lot of other sectors. So, I mean, even if you look at the components of CPI, right, you saw that just mechanistically, the beginning ramp of CPI was commodity based inflation, and then now, right, you're actually seeing it be a drag on headline CPI, even while a lot of the structural components are now sort of sustaining that fire, if you will. So I agree with you 100%. So maybe I'll amend my statement by saying it's not the spark. But it was probably the most, to me, it was the most visible spark, but perhaps driven by a lot of these same collinear variables that you're talking about.
Thank you, Michael. Let's go Joseph, then Jem, before I kick into the next question.
So I just wanted to follow up with Jim's point on populism. I think that's really important. And it also touches the central banks as well. So we talk about populism being inflationary. Next, we got to think, what about the central bank? Don't they have a mandate? But history shows that when you have a big cultural and political shift, the central bank has to bend its knee.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call. Because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
To that, we can think back to the 70s when we had Arthur Burns. We all think of him as some idiot who let inflation go out of control. But if you read his writings, a very famous speech called The Anguish of Central Banking, he'll talk about how back then, you know, he could have raised rates significantly, created a huge depression, and ended inflation easily. But he couldn't do it because he felt that there was this big cultural and political force, populism, that that was difficult to push against. So he had to relent. Now, when we fast forward to today, as we have more of a populistic culture and so forth, I think that's going to impact central banks here and throughout the world as well. So commonly, if you are an economist, you think of there being a trade-off between employment and inflation. So going forward, though, as we become more populist, there's going to be less of a willingness to raise unemployment to get inflation under control, to lower inflation. So you can hear hints of people talking about, you know, maybe we should raise the inflation target, right? You hear that being discussed in the Eurozone, as you do here in the US. And so that's kind of the Fed, central banks being, of course, subordinate to the popular culture, to the politics of our time.
Thank you, Joseph. Jim, one last comment here.
Yeah, so a couple quick things. You know, we keep looking at inflation as one number, right? And I want to be clear, monetary policy can cyclically slow the economy over short periods of time. You can bring down corporate profits, which will lead to layoffs and have a trickle down cyclically. But the problem is that the secular effects will continue, of populism will continue to be at play. And if anything, when you have downturns, you get more fiscal policy and you get more of a different reaction function. It's not about just monetary. Now you have fiscal and monetary stimulating at the same time, which then drives that next wave of inflation secularly. So this is what we see. One is structural and secular, which used to be, you know, deflationary and now is inflationary. In the meantime, we have a cyclical push by monetary policy to help try and control runaway inflation, but eventually will kind of give way. So I think it's an important mental model to think about it that way. Yes, inflation is coming down as a number now. It seems like a soft landing. When we went from 6% inflation in 1970 down to 2.5% in 1972 amidst that first recession, guess what? Everybody thought that was a soft landing, right? But the point is, the next move, one, the Fed had to pivot into a extended recession, was 12% inflation. And I think that's the important point. To Michael's point before, yes, oil was the first sign of this inflation, but that was because of the demand push that came from all the spending, from all the fiscal spending. And I want to be clear, we will get more of that when we get out of this cyclical downturn and they start stimulating again. Oil will run again and it will have the opposite effect. Whereas right now it has been inflation dampening because it's a cyclical factor. Oil tends to be tied to demand. It will be a you know, a stimulating factor to inflation, which will drive significantly higher inflation going forward.
Thank you, Jim. Now, last bear, I'm going to pick on you for the next question. But before I get to it, do you have any comments on what the other panelists have said so far, last bear?
No, let's just get right to the question.
Sounds great. So the New York Fed, John Williams, has said the stance of monetary policy is quite restrictive indeed. It's estimated to be the most restrictive in 25 years. So last bear, a couple twofer here. Do you agree with this stance? And kind of as a follow-up, is a more restrictive monetary policy warranted, or is it actually too strict?
I guess to start out, I would say I don't agree with that stance. I'd say that financial conditions have been easing for almost a year now. Basically, the tightest point in financial conditions was maybe last year around this time, maybe a little bit earlier than that. That was back when you had long-term yields sort of spike really aggressively into the fours for the first time. You had the BOE issue with the gilt market, all that kind of stuff. And it was also when we were seeing 75 basis point rate hikes, and there was uncertainty about the path of inflation, how fast and how high the Fed was going to go. But because the Fed has so much forward guidance, which again, we're going to see today with a new dot plot, and because since then it's been very well sort of telegraphed their ultimate destination and time period, I think that the market has a pivot here. So financial conditions by the Fed's measure has continued to ease. And if you just look at like capital markets activity, like, all these things are sort of related, but volatility, capital markets, issuance across any number of different categories, IPO windows back on, obviously there's more animal spirits than they were a year ago. So I really don't think that you can just look at the absolute level of the federal funds rate and say that that's indicative of what's practically happening, to the extent that the channel that you're sort of using to target inflation is sort of financial markets and capital market type activity, then I wouldn't say that that's the case. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it's not. Another point on that too, which like you can see as well, right? Like, so, you know, the fact that particularly in sort of single family housing has held up so well, despite sort of a move from 3% mortgage rates to 8% mortgage rates. And, you know, prices are continue to be on the rise, even despite that. There's a lot of sort of real world evidence, I think, that suggests that we're not in a restrictive, totally restrictive territory, even though there has been a huge move in rates.
Well, I'll jump in there real quick, Mr. Randy. You know, I don't know, when you talk housing or any kind of real estate, there isn't a lot of activity. You know, obviously, so many homes are going to be off market for a really long time because they got rates at 3%. And I know I've been watching commercial real estate really, really closely. Nothing's moving. We don't know what the price is. We don't know. And you could say, now, you might see a trophy, you know, okay, that's trophies and trash might trade, which is iconic buildings or whatever, or stuff that they know is just going to be a loss forever. So they just go ahead and take the loss. But for the most part, everything's being extended and pretended as far as loans that are supposed to be maturing right now. So I don't think we're having very good price discovery in anything real estate related right now. And I think that's, at least in commercial real estate, I think that's what we're going to start seeing next year. And that's the kind of thing I'm watching to be a big surprise that the Fed's going to maybe have to handle themselves.
Thank you, Randy. Joseph, I saw your hand as well.
Yeah, I'll just quickly add. So John Williams, president of the New York Fed, he's most known for his R-star model, which is a measure to judge whether or not monetary policy is restrictive or not, right? So if you move rates above R-star, you're restrictive. You move rates below R-star. So that's his thing. And when he says that monetary policy is as tight as it's been in 25 years, he's probably thinking of the world through the lens of his model. Now, just to rewind a little bit, all these model people, they were the people who were all in on team transitory and were totally wrong. So this way of looking at the world through economic models, I think has a long history of being very, very wrong. But, you know, that's kind of who he is. So I think I agree with the last bear. It doesn't seem like financial conditions are as tight as John Williams describes it to be. But it's important to keep in mind that's how he views the world, because he is a influential person in the Fed. Well, at least he votes. So that could color your view as to whether or not the Fed would become more hawkish or dovish going forward.
Well, real quick, I'll just say, in my world of community banking, maybe that doesn't mean anything anymore to the United States, but I doubt that. I think it's very meaningful. Their conditions of credit is as tight as it's ever been, both of what they can get and what they will provide. And all the regulators, everything they're doing behind the scenes are preparing to make that even worse, because they want to avoid more bank failures and more bank stress. So on the ground, you know, you talk to my CRE friends, they just, in some cases, they can't get the money. I mean, I got a friend who's in a loan syndicate for a building, and the bank that they're supposed to refi it with are like, we don't want the loan. You got to get it somewhere else. And they're like, no one wants to give them the money. And so they're in a real pickle. And then these are things that go unseen by the markets, because it's, you got to be in the business to see it. So I you know, in my world of financial community banking, it's as tight as it's ever been. And it's, I think, going to get worse.
See a couple hands here. Let's go Michael, then Jem, before I hit the next question.
Wow, there's so much to talk about here. First, let me just say that I agree with Last Bear's comments on just that the financial conditions have eased quite significantly. I think in November, by some metrics, saw like the largest easing of FCI since, gosh, I don't know when, but just given what the middle and long end of the yield curve has done, you've seen that essentially undo a lot of what the Fed has tried to do at the front end. That's comment number one. But I think Last Bear's point and Randy's point on its effect on different sectors, there's definitely an uneven impact, right? So I think that the issue here is that the most interest rate levered components of the economy, as well as global commodities that reflect the rest of the world's inability to keep up with the Fed, are also going to be impacted, which is what you're seeing. Now, I just want to give a couple of quick comments on my earlier comment on the structural and demographic dry tinder. So if you look at a demographic pyramid of the U.S., what I find fascinating is that after you see like the baby boom generation, came Gen X. That's actually my generation. And that's at a relative trough right now. And it just so happens that generation is the current, call it 45 to 59 year olds that comprise probably the most highly tenured part of the workforce. And I think that the fact that generation is at a relative trough is partially contributing to the labor stickiness. And if you want to talk about the ultimate driver of everything, right, the only way that the Fed can really engineer a disinflation, and I would argue perhaps they need to actually engineer a deflation, there's a big difference, is to get aggregate demand down. And the only way to get aggregate demand down is to get unemployment meaningfully higher. And it's not happening really yet. So that's on the employment side of things. Sorry, yeah, on the labor side of things. On the shelter side of things, what I find also interesting is, again, going back to the demographic pyramid, you see that the 30 to 39-year-old cohort is at a big relative peak right now. And what's significant about that cohort, it's primary household formation age. So this is the reason why the single family asset class, at least, has held up amazingly well, despite what mortgage rates have done. I just want to, just last comment on this theme is that I'm invested in a bunch of other hedge funds. One of them is a single family resi housing hedge fund. And from a couple of months ago, I got an update and they said that, household formation is still outpacing new construction by 600,000 units per year for the next 10 years. And they still forecast a significant shortage of 3 to 5 million housing units in the U.S. And then most recently, I just posted this on the 11th from their Q3 update. They said that after a peak to trough correction of 3% in the second half of 22, U.S. home prices have rebounded to a peak established in June of 22. The new home month supply is now down to 7.8 months, down from a peak of 10.1 months. And this mortgage lock-in effect, ironically, has actually exacerbated the supply shortage. So just another example of some of the structural reasons that Jem and I have been talking about.
Jem, I see your hand. I'm going to get your comments here, and then I'll get Randy's comments before a bonds question to Randy.
I jumped through the screen to try to raise my hand as high as possible here. The Okay, this is the most important point that people can understand. Everybody keeps 99.9% of the commentary you hear from people, from commentators, from the Fed themselves is about, are we in restrictive territory or not? Is the policy like strong enough to drive cyclical demand forces down? It's all missing the biggest part of the equation. The Fed does not have the proper tools to stop structural inflation. Actually, ironically, the more they raise interest rates, the more they stimulate structural inflation. Why? Because monetary policy acts from the supply side of the channel. It's not the demand side. When you lower interest rates, you send money to capital. You send money to corporations, to wealthy individuals who send more money to investment and corporations. When you raise interest rates, you take it away from corporations and the supply channel. So if you're taking money away from supply, which is what we're doing right now, what do you think that's going to do? Maybe not in the short term. The short term, it is going to cause a cyclical downturn, right? It's going to slow profits. There's going to be a trickle down to demand cyclically. But structurally, what you're going to do is you're going to drive more, less supply, less through both through deglobalization, through less technological development. All of the things that drove structural deflation for 40 years, right, are now reversing because the Fed is raising interest rates. Yes, cyclically, you can slow the economy with raising interest rates. But underneath it, you're actually creating a much worse, much worse supply picture. And that's true for real estate, as Michael alludes to, but also it's true for all supply. All the Ubers and Amazons and supply that you've been putting on the market through technological development, all of the globalization and opening of China and everything that is driven by lower interest rates, by free money, you're throwing out of the equation. So you're not just not helping secular inflation, you're making it worse. They don't really have a choice because of the fiscal stimulus and the policy. And then all of a sudden the Fed is now asked to step in and intervene, but the Fed cannot fix this. They can address it cyclically, but cyclically, if they do that cyclically, they're only making secular inflation worse. And I think that's the structural part that people need to talk about more, not just focus on this two-dimensional inflation number and the cyclical realities. Are we in recession? Are we not?
Thank you, Jim. Now, Randy, I saw your hand up there as well. If you wanted to give a few quick comments before I pick on you about bonds.
Now, just very quickly, I think, I think it was last person standing on, maybe they got to create deflation. I don't think there's any hell in chance of that. That's what Bernanke wrote a lot about in all his, his talk about Great Depression is you can never allow for deflation because that snowball can get rolling and they can't stop that. And that's, I think, why they have this 2% mandate. But, anecdotally, I think if you can go back, if you can find it, you probably can't, but two or three times someone in Powell's presser has asked about his efforts to bring prices down. And he about jumps over the podium. He goes, hold on. That is absolutely what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is bring the pace of inflation down. So he's very, very adamant that I'm not looking to bring prices down. I don't think a lot of people in the world understand that because you get a lot of comments on Twitter like, well, prices aren't down. So but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the change in the inflation, the prices pay, pace of change. So that, then that's what I'm always watching for is, when is somebody going to really challenge them? I'm going, so what you're saying is all these high prices we're seeing are never coming down. And I think that'll be a challenging question for them. That's what I'd like to see.
Can I just jump in real quick, Randy? I just want to point to a tweet that I just retweeted. I shared it into the Nest. And, I think this is just worth acknowledging because, when you think about the compound effects of 3 years of high inflation, this is what you get. If you click through to that chart from Charlie Bellello, I think. So it's a big problem. So I guess that's my reasoning for, I said that earlier comment about deflation versus disinflation, but just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I'm talking about. It's like, that's why they invented the word disinflation. You know, I've never really ever heard that word used, because they definitely don't want anybody referring to lower prices. That's not what they're trying to do, and it's not what they want. And I just, there's very few people who understand that.
Thank you all. I think really good points to keep in mind here. And so one thing I wanted to touch on here, because it mostly due to my fault in terms of managing our time during the panels, but we don't really get to talk in depth about bonds all that much, given those time constraints. So I'm going to ask a quick question here that hopefully won't bore the audience. So following the CPI release in the morning, we saw the 30-year bond auction occur. That was this week as well. The high yield was 4.344% versus the when-issued level of 4.37%. Now, Randy, I would love if you could give us an overview of why that 30-year bond auction is so important to the markets and what yesterday's auction says about what's to come. Randy?
You know, honestly, I don't know who the hell buys 30-year bonds. I've never sold one in my life. So that, you know, when you look at the 30-year, it's sort of, you don't even know who's in that game. And I think that's a trader's game. That's not a buy and hold game. And there's so many moving parts to why the yield goes up, why it goes down, and why, you know, on these auctions, whether it's a good auction or bad auction, you know, we've had a lot of horrible auctions. Oh my God, this is the worst auction we've seen. But the yield's lower than it was yesterday. So clearly, you know, the auctions behave one way or another, but in the end, you know, the buyers decide where that's going to go. And, you know, I will say my opinion on bond demand, which I think is important. And I think a couple of fellows here said, you know, they see yields going up. I think Joseph has been talking quite a bit about that. All I can tell you is when my banks get money again, they're going to be buying treasuries probably more than they have in their, well, certainly they're in their careers, but probably more than they have in the last 30, 40 years. Things have changed dramatically. You know, Silicon Bank and First Republic and all that, it's changed mentality. It's changed how banks are going to behave going forward. So there's going to be, I can go on and on about all the reasons why, but there's going to be more demand for treasuries and probably a little less demand for mortgages, which could be interesting on its impact on mortgage rates.
Thank you, Randy. So you did mention Joseph there.
I'm not sure I answered
there.
Your question. I apologize. But
no, I think you hit the head, and that initial who's buying this comment really killed me.
Yeah, but good, bad. In my career, there's always good, bad auctions. They never really amount to anything. There's, like I said, there's so many moving parts in the dynamics of when and how people buy bonds and who's buying the bonds. It's never really mattered to me. And it never points to any sort of momentum one way or another.
I think that's fair, Randy. Thank you. And I do want to kick back a little bit here to your mention of Joseph chatting a bit about this, because kind of tying back in bonds to inflation, the Fed's Barkin recently said, quote, on the topic of a target range, he said, "I'm open to an inflation target range once we hit our 2% goal." And Joseph, you did have some comments on that in your recent Twitter posts, saying shifting to a target range is how the inflation target will be moved higher, and that long bond under 5% is crazy in your opinion. So Joseph, just to kind of tie back to what Randy was saying as well, if you'd like, I'd love you to touch on each of these comments for our listeners today as well.
Yeah, I agree with Randy. I have no idea where all these people buying these 30-year bonds. I'm guessing it's insurance companies or someone who's trying to manage the liabilities. So, you know, right now we have an inflation target of 2%, right? So that means that if inflation is at 2.5%, that's above target, we got to do something about it. But if you move to an inflation band, which from what I understand, there is growing support for this within the Fed, then that's a whole nother game. It's very much similar to changing the target. So let me explain. Let's say that you have an inflation band that is 1.5 to 2.5% instead of just 2% target. That means when inflation gets down to 2.5%, well, mission accomplished, I don't have to do anything. So in a sense, you are shifting the inflation target from 2% to 2.5%. And just an aside, I totally agree with Randy's comments earlier that, you know, when we're talking about stable prices being the mandate for the Fed, well, you know, that's not the same as having a stable inflation rate, right? Prices stably go up 2%. If you were someone who bought something a few years ago, well, the price level went up 20%, 30% in a few years. It's never going to come down. That's not stable prices. Even if the inflation rate goes back to 2%, you know, unless you get some decrease in the price level, that's not stable prices. So this interpretation is strange. But that's how it's being interpreted. And in the future, though, if there was a way to raise the inflation target, I think that's how they would do it, through a band, because it sounds a lot less, a lot less like they're moving the goalposts, like they're just kind of changing things around a little bit. But looking at all these huge secular forces that we've been talking about, like populism, like tremendous deficit spending, things like that, that's difficult for me to see how the inflation would remain around 2%, and how the 30-year bond, where it is, 30 years is a long time. It makes sense.
Hey, Joseph, you can help me with this. I forget the lingo, but do you remember, you know, in 1819, where Powell, where they were talking about, hey, we've been under 2% for so long, we're going to need to, what is it, like average it? There's a certain unique little way he put it. We need to let it run above 2% for a certain period of time. So the on average, it's 2%. Do you remember how he explained that?
Yeah, that's average inflation targeting. That was a change in the Fed's framework in 2020. Yeah. I'm sure they've more than made up of it now.
Yeah, well, but they're never going to, I don't think they'll ever say, well, it's been so high for so long, we can go below 2%. Fact is, they don't want to be anywhere near zero. I mean, that's their nightmare scenario. And, you know, so I think that whole targeting thing, you'll never hear them say that again. It was to their, you know, own use back then, but they've changed their mind on that one for sure.
You're right. It's asymmetric. It's not symmetric. So they're not going to run periods of deflation to make up.
Thank you, guys. Really good explanations there. And I do kind of want to just kind of continue down this vein for a little bit. I think about 15 minutes until we get some numbers. So as a follow-up here, Last Bear, have you ever bought the 30-year? No, I'm just kidding. But I am curious, Last Bear, could you maybe touch on why this month's high yield rate of 4.344% comes across much more favorably than last month's 4.769%? The tail this month was negative 0.3 basis points, which many viewed as encouraging from what the reading I was doing. Many viewed that as encouraging for the bonds market, given last month's auction with that tail of 5.3 basis points. So from your point of view, Last Bear, and Joseph and Randy, feel free to chime in here as well after Last Bear, what does the drop in high yield rates say about investor sentiment for bonds? And kind of what do you see for the future of yields in 24?
That's a great question. I think with respect to the auction, I mean, that's just supposed to be an indication of relative demand. Having a large tail is bad. Having a negative tail be a good thing. And particularly given that there's been a lot of focus around the treasury issuance and the size of that, the size of particularly long-dated treasury issuance that might be coming after the debt ceiling, all that kind of stuff. I think that there was a heightened focus around those, and maybe it got more attention than typically it might for a normal auction. But I do think that it is interesting that it was sort of the peak of concern around treasury issuance, probably coincided with the peak in yields. And since then, yields have come off pretty substantially on the long end, as we've seen some encouraging inflation data, as well as some sort of weakening economic data, if you look at sort of GDP forecasts, that sort of thing. So I think that maybe on the auction point, just it does go to show that there is plenty of capital available for the U.S. government to borrow money, so long as investors are seeing that as being a good investment proposition, which for long duration assets, obviously there's a carry component or the interest rate component, but there's also the direction of rates and the sensitivity to, you know, duration. So to the extent that investors view interest rates as being lower or coming down over the coming year, then the absolute, you know, yield of these bonds is maybe less significant than the opportunity for principal appreciation for long duration assets like that. So I think, you know, on the flip side, if investors expect rate cut, you know, rate hikes to continue going forward, and those look like poor investments, there's obviously less demand. But I don't think that there's a lack of total capital available. I think it's more about whether investors view those in an attractive way, given the sort of the monetary dynamics.
Thank you, Les. I see some hands here. Let's go Michael, then Randy, before I move on to the next question.
I want to call attention to another thing I just put into the nest, which I think is kind of interesting, because I was studying the rate hike cycle of the late 70s. And you know, I posted this when, you know, yields were at their peak, right? And to kind of put into context the relative bear steepening that we saw compared to what we saw during the periods of 79 through 82. And so what you see, let me just walk through this somewhat busy chart. What you see here is that in, so the bottom, the red and the blue are, were the recent bear steepening that we saw at peak yields, right? So then I basically posted the yield curves from, I just picked an arbitrary date, January 1st of 79, 80, 81, and 82. And so what you see is that during that period where the front end, the Fed was hiking the front end very, very aggressively, right? You saw a similar type of stair-stepping happen where the front end would go get jacked up, you know, via Fed funds. And then maybe after a period of time, the long end would adjust and basically bear steepen. But I want to call your attention to the orange line at the very top, what happened in 82. Because by the time 82 rolls around, right, the economy's deep into recession and the Fed actually cut, right? You see the Fed funds go way down, right? But look at what the long end did. The long end completely blew out in a, I guess, a combination of a bull and bear steepener at that point. And I point this out because I see this as a potential danger here for the Fed if they prematurely cut. Because I think what the bond market was saying at that point in 1982 was, you know what, the inflation expectations had basically gotten out of the bag. And we don't believe that you can stuff that genie back in the bottle. And I think that's basically what happened in 82. So I think here, this is totally relevant to the Fed's forward guidance and what they might do in terms of communicate via the dots today. Because I think that if they make the mistake of a premature cut, I actually think the long end is going to get crushed. That's my view.
Thank you much. Randy, I saw your hand there as well. Please feel free to chime in.
Yeah, just back on the 30-year. So this is something everybody should know. If you haven't read and followed Mike Green from Simplify Asset, you should. And what you want to do is listen to his thesis on passive investing and in equities. It completely changed my thoughts on how equity prices move and whatnot. And you got to look into that. However, it was like a year or two after I was reading it. One day he said, yeah, this is bonds too. And I was like, oh, holy shit. I didn't even think about that. So let's go look at an old 30-year treasury, 3% of 215.49. Guess the three largest holders outside the Federal Reserve, which they own a lot, BlackRock, Fidelity, and Vanguard, meaning that their index funds, whatever long bond index fund, you put a dollar in there, it has to go to that treasury. It's got to go to long treasuries. So there's no thought, there's no analysis, there's no nothing, there's no trading. You give them a dollar and it's going to get dispersed and it's probably going to go to the one they own the most because it's kind of a market cap situation. That's where the money's going to go. So, you know, and also I think, you know, someone just mentioned this as far as price appreciation. I think that's a trader, right? That's who's buying these things, is they're kind of gambling on, I think the, you know, Fed's going to cut and rates are going to come down. And you're going to get good price appreciation, but I don't think there's any really not meant. Well, Lacey Hunt's probably the only person who buys 30-year treasuries, which he's done for his entire career. But outside that, I don't know anybody else who does. But point being, passive income's going into those long bonds.
Thank you, Randy. Does anybody else on the panel have any comments before I pick on Jem some more? All right. So, Jem, as always, it would be criminal to not pick your brain about the VIX. So as of this month, the VIX is trading at its lowest point since before the COVID pandemic and is down around 48% year to date. So, Jem, could you give us a little insight into the implied volatility of the markets? And additionally, is low implied volatility any indication of future rate cut projections?
So, no to that last question. The primary drivers of implied volatility at this juncture are structural. They're structural to the vol markets themselves. They're structural to seasonal factors and flows happening in the market at this time. You gotta have to always remember that implied volatility is a function of time. If the market stands still for a month, but prices don't move, implied volatility will go higher. Implied volatility levels are also, and this is a part that many people do not understand, but is very important, are also a function of moneyness in the market. You know, there are higher strikes in the market have lower implied volatilities, and lower strikes have higher implied volatilities. The demand or pricing of options can just simply not change, and the market can go down and implied volatilities in the VIX will go up. It has nothing to do with demand or supply of volatility. So there's a lot of elements here that people just simply don't understand. A 20% rally, more importantly, a 12% rally or whatever it is off the bottom, the recent bottom in the last month or so, month and a half, naturally slid us to really low implied volatilities. And the more we continue to rally, the more that implied volatility is low. But as I've mentioned on many, many platforms for a month and a half, two months now, demand in the form of structural end of the year reflexive recollateral investment is a major seasonal driver of the support and demand in this market. And as that comes into the market and continues to force people risk on, especially into an end of year squeeze where people have to perform is also a major driver. So every day that this market goes higher, we slide naturally to a lower implied volatility. At some point, you're so stretched that you're hitting up against two standard deviations, three standard deviations up on monthly charts. But the pace is so fast that people are willing to write calls or to sell, create supply. Not to mention there becomes more and more reflexive action from, like we're going to see today, from the Federal Reserve, from the Treasury, that are going to try and slow it down and talk down the market. And all of these things end up being a push and pull, a macro versus flows, like I mentioned, that helps to compress volatility. Lastly, I think maybe the most important piece of this is that December quarterly, which we're coming into that expiration here this Friday morning, is by far the biggest expiration for structured products, for volatility issuance. It's been leaps. It's been on the market for a dramatic amount of time. And so it is it is easy for sophisticated options traders and dealers to go sell that volatility, which is significantly higher and has short open interest, and it's going away, and use that to fund volatility behind it, which is much cheaper. So as this expiration goes away, everybody is getting handed cheaper implied volatility behind it. Not only is it cheap, but they're getting a credit on what's going away. So they're getting handed it incredibly cheap. I can own the January 3rd upside calls on an 8 implied volatility. And I can fund that with out of the money strangles that are very high up to my margin levels in Friday expiration. That gets me into a 6 volatility in these calls. When those supply demand dynamics exist in the marketplace, when you're able to get these incredibly low implied volatilities, it is a structural reality that the world is decaying longer and longer implied volatility. And when everybody's getting handed more and more supply of implied volatility at a low level, that means implied volatility is going to go lower. And that is what we have been seeing.
Thank you, Jim. I think we're getting our numbers here. And then I definitely want to circle back to some more volatility questions as well, but I'm just going to give folks a few minutes here to kind of digest what we're seeing. Again, the report should have just dropped, so I don't want to get ahead of ourselves too far. Looks like we are sitting on another pause, which I think was pretty widely accepted and expected. If anybody has any comments here while we're digesting, feel free.
Check out the dots. I might be wrong on this, but let me make sure I got it right. Let's see. Last time they were 2024, they had it at 515. If you average them all out, that's now down to 465. So it looks like they've been dropping. I'm going to compare.
Yeah, the dots look substantially lower.
Right. So
across
this
the
is
board.
So last time there was only penciled in 2 cuts for next year, and now it looks like it's closer. It's 3 yeah. cuts now. So this is a realization that inflation has made tremendous progress.
Yeah. And hey, guys, just this is something that I don't know how everybody is on this, but it's a fact. CME, FedWatch, they don't do the math right. So their probabilities are absolutely wrong.
I actually had a question geared for that, so please do go over that.
Yeah, it shows itself at inflection points. So if anybody wants it, Bloomberg wrote about this. So back in 2018, Bloomberg and CME were using what's called conditional probability, where basically you have a max of 100%. And that forces percentages into buckets they don't belong. And when, say rate cuts, when you start to get to these cuts, you're getting closer to it, it pushes the percentages to places like, there's a 20% says it's going to be 3 cuts by this time. Well, that's just absolutely 100% wrong. So the May is the one, May meeting is the one you want to focus on. But, so anyway, in 18, Wall Street went to Bloomberg and CME and said, you're doing it wrong. Here's why you're doing it wrong. And Bloomberg realized, oh, we're doing it wrong. So they changed how they did it and corrected it. CME, for whatever reason, has not. And it shows up at inflection points. So we're going to see that in cuts. And when you get into May, that's where CME just goes bonkers. So May right now for WIRP, World Interest Rate Probability on Bloomberg, is trading at basically 118, which is 100%. I actually started to say, instead of probability, I probably should say severity, 100% severity that there's going to be a cut at that meeting. And the 18.2.182 is 18.2% that of a second 25 basis point cut. CME at that meeting, let's see, make sure I got May. Yeah. They have right now, let me refresh it, let me make sure, because it's changing as we speak. Well, a little bit ago, they have 20.2% that they remain where they are right now. Well, that's absolutely not what the Fed Funds futures are trading at. They don't, they're trading at zero that rates are going to be right where they are right now. And that's already immediately wrong. And that's where, and then they have 49 with 1 cut, 29% with 2 cuts. They actually have 1.2% with 3 cuts. All wrong, all wrong, all wrong. And to make it worse, they got a 0.3% chance of a hike. And that's the error of what conditional probability produces into these numbers. So it's frustrating for, Bianco, I finally had to correct him. And he was like, well, why the hell are they doing this? Like, what about people who don't have Bloomberg? I'm like, I know. I mean, we've tried to contact CME, they just won't change it. But if you want the literature, DM me your email and I'll send it to you. And Bloomberg does a much better job educating you on how that works.
Hell yeah. Thank you, Randy. Last Bear, did you have some comments here as we digest?
Yes, unmuted. Yeah, so this is a big shift in the dots downward across the board from the last September meeting where they had dots. And obviously you're seeing that in the equity market right now with market up about 0.5% since that's come out. But I just want to emphasize that, I'm somewhat surprised by how much of a move this is since September, which only 3 months ago. If you look at their inflation numbers or their inflation expectations, those have come down slightly. Growth is about the same. So clearly, from the Fed's perspective, there's been a big shift. And I'm a little bit surprised, to be honest, that it's that large. And I'm not sure what kind of data or, you know, what was the driving factor of that, whether it's concern around the weakening labor market and sort of balancing the risks on the downside, or whether it's because of just higher degree of confidence in the rate of inflation. But I think no one was expecting any sort of real surprise, but this is a big shift in the dots. You see it in the across the yield curve, 10 bips down. Obviously the equity market is up a lot too. So it's an interesting for what was supposed to be a not interesting report here.
Any other comments here on the change in dot plots or anything else that you're seeing as you digest?
So let me say real quick. So you guys, I don't know who here would know about this, but about 6 months ago or so, and this doesn't happen that often, and I'm sure Joseph saw it. The Fed, the OCC, the NCUA even, and the FDIC, they sent out a combined statement to all banks and credit unions. And what it said was, hey, in this time of stress with commercial lending, extending the term of the loan to give time to heal and to, you know, basically fix some of these issues that these borrowers are having, they promoted it. And then they gave about a half a dozen examples of, okay, so let's take this loan. And basically what it was is they were saying, hey, normally if you redefined, you know, if you extended a loan and it turns out that that went from a 70 LTV to a 110 LTV, normally that would be a bad thing because that's, you're taking on too much risk there. They were saying, we're going to be okay with that. And they went through all these examples explaining why they're going to be okay with that. My opinion was they clearly feel rates are going to come down next year. And it's like, guys, give them time. Rates are going to be lower next year. A lot of the problems these people are having will be not fully alleviated, but it'll be less so. Because I don't think they're ever going to the rates they were, and particularly they'll never have cap rates as low as they were, and they will never do, you know, 75-85% LTV lending in that structure either in that world. So anyway, that's what I think. That's totally, the dots fit right in with what I was thinking when I saw that directive from all the regulators.
Thank you much, Randy. Any other comments, maybe Joseph or Jim or Michael?
I do think one element that is going to become interesting over the coming year is what happens with QT. I know we've talked about rates a lot. I don't think we've mentioned balance sheet dynamics at all, the Fed's balance sheet dynamics. But I think particularly given this sort of dovish read through from the dots and just sort of obviously long anticipated rate cuts, it will be interesting to see the questions begin to start on QT. And so there's still 700 million or 700 billion in the reverse repo facility that's still needs to sort of, that's excess liquidity, so to speak, that still can come out and that will continue to support QT for, much of the coming year to the extent that they want to extend that. But it will be interesting to see something to watch if they make any comment or change that policy in the coming year, because I think a lot of the dynamics that Randy's referenced throughout this, the bank dynamics are really important dynamics to understand, which is that, there was a huge explosion in the size of basically bank balance sheets, which was a result of Fed's quantitative easing and sort of, during the period of COVID.
Well, it was more so stimulus. I think it had, I mean, the shit, man, the amount of money they sent out for just direct deposit
funded. How is that funded?
Yeah, that's a good point. Right. You're right. So indirectly, you're right. Yeah. But I think the government demanded it, and the Fed's like, all right, I guess we got to fund it.
I totally agree with you. But and that's been on the downward trend for the past year and a half or so. And that's, you know, the fact that all these banks are actually shrinking in size. It's a very unusual situation. That's why they're so tight on credit. You know, that's why you have the sort of organic credit channel slow down the way that it has. But that's not really a sustainable long-term sort of path. And so eventually that line should start moving up again. It's kind of stabilized, and that's been a policy decision as they've tried to sort of tame inflation. But moving forward, I think that there's going to be more of an inclination to get that into a more normal place, which is sort of gradual and steady growth as opposed to a large increase and then sort of the subsequent decrease we've seen over the past year or so.
Yeah, I'll tell you this, man, you know, with all the money that they put at these banks and the banks, you know, look, you can't just sit on cash. There's a lot of reasons why you can't just sit on cash. Got the money in loans. They got it in bonds. And then turn around, you jack rates up and you have a bunch of bank failures. They're never falling for that again. So, I mean, that trick's dead. So I'm thinking when they do have to stimulate, and they will one day have to stimulate, they're going to have a hard time getting banks on board because you just screwed the hell out of them this year, and they're not going to let you do that to them again.
All right. If nobody has any other comments on the initial release here.
I'll mention something. So
yeah, please.
As was mentioned before, this is clearly a dovish meeting, dovish statement. The reason it's dovish is because last September, you were pricing in two cuts for 2024, and now you're pricing in three. And that largely seems to be because disinflation has been progressing faster than expected, right? So you can see in the 2023 core PC inflation, it's 3.2 rather than 3.7. Now, the second part of this that I think is also dovish, but also very interesting, is how the committee views their quote unquote R star, that is to say, the longer run level of where interest rates will be. Now, over the past year, there's this R star, this longer term Fed funds rate projection has been creeping higher. So there was more of a belief on the committee that maybe there's something structurally different in the economy such that going forward, inflation could be structurally higher. And so maybe rates will have to be structurally higher as well. Now that person or group of people seems to have gone back to thinking that the future will look like the past. And so you see that longer run Fed funds rate kind of come down a bit in the brackets.
Joseph, real quick on those dots, like let's just say 25, is that where they think they'll be by the end of 25 or the beginning of 25?
End.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
And I think the last bear makes a really good point in that going forward, now the focus is going to be how the Fed will handle their balance sheet. So historically speaking, Fed has this dogma where they don't want to do different things with the balance sheet and the policy rate. The thinking is you don't want to step on the gas and the brake at the same time. Now, there's been more and more discussion within the Fed. It's seemingly more of a minority now, but still some discussion that maybe even as we cut rates next year, we could continue to let QT continue, because what we're doing is that we're not so much changing the stance of policy, but we're just normalizing things. So as we normalize policy, it would make sense to let the balance sheet continue to run off so that we're just normalizing the balance sheet as well. My expectation is this group actually gains ascendance since we have more and more stability in the bond market at the moment. So I think the Fed gives the Fed some space to actually continue to run down their balance sheet, even as they cut rates to tailor monetary policy in line with lower inflation.
Thank you all. So we've got about 15 minutes, I believe, until Jerome Powell's presser. And there's one thing that I did want to touch on that Last Bear mentioned a little bit ago. And I'm going to pick on you again here, Joseph. So Last Bear mentioned that many voiced a concern recently regarding that of the RRP hitting zero. Now, according to Lynn Alden, the RRP reaching zero signals an end of an excess cash regime, which wouldn't necessarily cause instantaneous issues. She goes on to say, however, that if Fed QT continues to persist and the RRP is drained, there could potentially be serious consequences in liquidity and elevated risk in the money market. So let's start with Joseph and then kick it around the panel here. Is this concern warranted? As the RRP dwindles, are we at risk of liquidity issues, and does anyone actually care?
So the way that I think of it is that when the RRP is at zero, and that means that short-term interest rates will start to go up. So if you have money in the RRP, let's just, for example, earning 5%, then whenever interest rates elsewhere in the market, say treasury bills or private repo, go above 5%, then you take money out and you lend it there because you can earn better than 5%. Now, when the RRP is zero, that means that, so because of this, interest rates are pinned or at least pulled towards the RRP offering rate. Now, when the RRP is zero, then that ceases to be an anchor for short-term interest rates, and so they can drift higher. Now, if you look, let's say the past few years, the RRP has been zero, you know, before the pandemic, it was zero. So it's not a big deal. What that just means is that short-term interest rates go higher until they find the next lender. Now, the next lender is probably going to be the commercial banks. And so you would think short-term interest rates, let's say repo, let's say T-bills, drift above interest on reserves, which is what the commercial banks earn on their deposits at the Fed. So I think it's just, for me, it means that the interest rates go higher a little bit. And however, if the commercial banks get tapped out, then you can have some, I think, more volatility and some, as Lynn mentioned, you kind of run out of money in some parts of the market. But I think that's some ways away.
Hey, Joseph, they can never, if that short-term rate started going up, if repos started going up, they got to go back in because SOFR is sourced primarily off repos. And if they're going to control SOFR, they have to got to ring fence rates. So they got to have repo ready to go and they got to have reverse repo ready to go. Don't you think?
Well, I think it can go, let's say, above IOR, around IOR, and be fine. I think that the problem would emerge if it went a lot higher or became very volatile. I don't think that's going to happen right away. You would have to exhaust the commercial banks first. So I think it has room to go up, say, 10 basis points.
I think you'd agree. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thinking that they thought in September 2019 when repo went all blue to hell. And that's what I'm just saying is like, hey, they'll jump. If they got to jump back in, they'll jump right back in. They may let it move around in a range, but if it starts to, you know, whack out SOFR again, there's no way. I mean, that's the metric they want to control more than anything in the world.
Well, remember, though, we also have something new called the standing repo facility, and that makes uncontrollable spikes very unlikely.
Okay. What about the floor? What facility controls so it won't go too low?
The reverse repo facility.
Right. Okay. That's what I'm thinking. And that's why I thought, well, you know, I know it was small, but, you know, SOFR spiked last Friday or something like that. And they threw, you know, I think they threw $200 million into repo, which was the most since, you know, they were correcting it back in 19. Everybody's like, it doesn't mean anything. It's just $200 million. To me, that was the message, boys. We'll go right back in if we need to, but get that goddamn rate back down because we're not letting you, you know, move this index too far away from where we want it.
Great discourse there, Randy and Joseph. Thank you. Last Bear, did you have some comments there as well?
Yeah, so I would tend to agree a little bit more. I think those are all good points. I tend to agree a little bit with Lynn's comments that you referenced, which is that it is very noteworthy to sort of follow the reverse repo dynamics. So basically since June of this past year, till now, you've probably had something on the order of $1.5 trillion come out of the reverse repo facility and into either commercial banks or effectively sort of shredded in QT. And so that's allowed QT to basically be sort of a non-issue this year because it's basically getting funded from money that was sort of sitting at the Fed anyways. So if you think of that as sort of an overflow facility, we've sort of drawn down about 75% or maybe a little bit less than that in the course of 6 months. And so once you get down to zero, if that happens sometimes in the coming year, there's potential for more rate volatility on the short end, which is what these guys are referencing. But there's also issues for the banking sector as well, to the extent that QT was to continue and basically take reserves only out of the banking sector as opposed to the reverse repo facility, then you start to have liquidity pressure on banks that for all the, how Randy's talking about how challenging it is for sort of the banks right now, they've actually benefited slightly over the past couple months of sort of increased liquidity because money is coming out of the reverse repo facility and into the banking sector. So once that sort of, overflow facility gets drawn down to zero, and to the extent that QT continues, then it will start taking money out of the banking sector, which will put further pressure on these sort of banks. So I think that that's, there's sort of a concept called the lowest comfortable level of reserves in the commercial banking sector that the Fed focuses on when making their balance sheet decisions. And I think that those are all going to be the dynamics that they're considering as they sort of make their plans with QT, because that's sort of the big risk out there with sort of extending QT for an extended period of time is that you end up having a blowout in rates or having some issues with banks.
Thank you, Last Bear. So we've got about 8 minutes before the presser. So what I want to do here is kind of go around the panel, get some closing thoughts, and please plug anything you've got coming out that people should be checking out here before we get into the presser. Jim, I see your hand. Let's go ahead and start with you, Jim.
I was just going to say one thing about liquidity. I mean, I think it's very important that that spike in SOFR happened at the end of the month. And that spoke to kind of this need for liquidity at the end of the month. End of the year is even bigger. So I'll be very curious to see what happens here at the end of the year with this liquidity situation. I think that's something to highlight, to kind of look for. I do think it's a bit of a canary in the coal mine. Again, I'll always cede kind of the plumbing to Joseph here, but I am concerned about liquidity after the first of the year. I do think that date matters. So I'll just leave that there and we can shelve that for another conversation. But I do think early next year is going to be an interesting time for supply. And I do think the Fed will be pushed back in through one of these facilities to try and provide liquidity to the Treasury. And I think that could very well be kind of an interesting dynamic to markets. In terms of us, find me on Twitter here at Jim_Croissant, KaiVolatility.com/news if you want to subscribe to kind of our thoughts and our media. I think we're approaching a really important window, as I've highlighted in a lot of other venues here in early January 17th in particular. The new year, we'll see the end of some of these structural flows that I've highlighted. And I think the next level up here is market up, vol up, and that tends to unpin vol and create more dynamic, dangerous situations for markets. So something to watch. Higher is not necessarily better for, this thing goes too far too fast. It ends up being a very dangerous situation for markets, as we've seen many other times in the past.
Thank you, Jim. Definitely check out Kai Volatility, guys. Up next, Michael, any closing thoughts here? Anything you want to plug before we head into the presser?
Sure. I guess I'll end with what I started with, which is that I think that ultimately I'm surprised by these dovish dots as much as anybody else. But it's important to remember that in the end, the Fed is a monarchy and not a democracy. And my own view is that I'm going to be very, very attentive to what happens to financial conditions as a result of this. And I have a sneaky suspicion that this will be self-defeating and that we're at a later FOMC, we're going to see the dots migrate back up. And I can be found at Urban Cowboy, the KAO, and my Substack is urbancowboy.com. Thanks for having me.
Thanks as always for coming, Michael. Next, Last Bear, anything you want to plug? Any closing comments here?
Closing comments, but if you like anything that I say here, you can follow me here on Twitter and check out my Substack. I put out a post every Friday, so check that out.
Check it out, folks. A lot of valuable info in Last Spare. Randy, anything you wanted to say here before we push these folks into the presser?
Yeah, real quick. So Zoltan has got his new release today. So, and he does talk about RRP. So if you have $30,000 a year, you too can get his commentary. I don't get it. So just thought I'd let you all know. Let's see here. The only other thing I would say is there's a new book out called Rigged. By Andy Verity, he's the BBC financial reporter. Everyone in finance should read that book. It's all about the LIBOR scandal, and everything that you've been told, and I completely agree with this, is all bullshit. That, you know, there are a bunch of scapegoats that the powers that be needed so they could kill LIBOR and take this index over, which is now SOFR. So I highly recommend that book. It's fantastic, well-written. Some of the characters in there are on Twitter, and some are not because they're just still too distraught for spending time in jail. But highly recommend that book.
Thank you much, Randy. And thank you as always for coming and giving us some of that bond feedback. I know we missed touching on that on a couple of these in the past. So it was really nice to touch on that in depth today. Joseph, anything you want to say sending these folks into the presser here in about 3 minutes?
Well, first, I would just briefly address the point made by Jim and Randy. So on month ends, definitely there's less liquidity in the repo market, but I wouldn't worry about it because it's something that happens all the time. So it kind of stopped for a couple of years. But if you look, let's say before 2019, it actually used to happen every month end. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. And, you know, standing repo facility, it's there. There's a test trade. My guess is about $200 million, so I wouldn't worry about that either.
I'll push back real quick. You know what? SOFR didn't exist in 2019. I mean, I think it's a whole, now that they chose repo to represent the market in SOFR, I'd love to talk to you about that, but I think it's a different ballgame now. Sorry, guys, I cheated. Sorry.
Got it. All right. So anyway, I have a YouTube channel, Joseph Wang. Check it out. I will put a FOMC debrief on it after the FOMC. And also, I actually went on cable news yesterday and told everyone that I thought the meeting would be dovish and that there would be 3 hikes penciled in. So I'm actually happy with this outcome. And you can see that interview on my YouTube channel. So check it out.
Check that out for sure, folks. Again, thank you to all of our panelists today. If you're not following them, you absolutely should be. All of them have very in-depth experience keeping an eye on the macro landscape and kind of what's going on, you know, in the Fed and commodities. So if you're not following these folks, if you're not subscribed to their Substacks, please do that. You're missing out on a lot of good information. And all of these folks up here and all the folks we've had up here break things down in a very easy to understand way. And I don't say that lightly. If I can understand it, you guys can understand it too. We won't be having another space this year. This is the last one of 2023. So I hope everybody has a phenomenal holiday season and new year going into 2024. Thanks for coming, folks.